me start. Welcome to this statistical physics primer. And as I say, our goal is to make you ready for Pedro's course, but we will fail because nothing can make you ready for Pedro's course. So you have something to look forward to in this course. It's a very non-standard course on statistical physics. In fact, it's so non-standard that he didn't call it statistical physics, but he called it something else. He called it like random walks and stuff like that. So anyway, there will be lots of fun, this course. So in order to make you a little bit ready, I want to discuss the statistical ensembles, and I want to discuss the thermodynamic and the microscopic approaches to phase transitions. So that when Pedro talks about phase transitions, you actually know at least a little bit about them. Okay, so I put some primer text notes on the wiki, which are basically first few chapters from a course I delivered a couple years ago. So please use them, or I actually uploaded the full text. So if you are interested in the normalization group in statistical physics and stuff like that, you can read my notes on the wiki. But anyway, without further delay, let's just go ahead and let's start discussing the ensembles. And so we will have three chapters, and the first chapter will be called like basics of statistical physics. Basics of statistical physics. And I just want to give you some handle how to approach statistical physics. And so the first part will be from quantum to classical. And so you know that our world is deeply quantum mechanical, but under certain circumstances, actually, we can use classical physics to describe what's happening. And so let me just take the approach where I tell you how it is actually correctly, what is the correct description in quantum language, and how you actually can make a transition, what is the dictionary between going from quantum to a classical description. Okay, so we know that the quantum systems can be described by a pure state sometimes. So if we have a microstate of a quantum system, so then we have a pure state or a microstate. And it's simply some vector in the Hilbert space. And this is our Hilbert space here. The vector can be normalized to one. It's really all the rays describe the same state. So this is how you describe the microstates. And of course, the time evolution of these things is described by the Schrödinger equation. Okay. However, you can also have mixed states. So we have a pure state, or we have a mixed state. Which basically corresponds to a macroscopic state. Not really, but. And so mixed state means that I don't know really, you know, which pure state is happening. So I have some mixture of pure states, and I can only find, you know, this pure state with some probability, that pure state with some another probability, and so on. And so the mixed states are described by the density matrix. And so the density matrix. And the density matrix is simply sum over all possible states which I can find. So let's call them lambda. And then P lambda, psi lambda, psi lambda. Okay? So these are the states, the pure states which I could find. And this is the probability I can find that given state. Is there anybody who has not seen density matrices? Okay, one. Okay, so this is what it is. Now you know what it is. So it's simply, it's an operator. So this is a vector. Well, this is the dual vector to that. And so this is a matrix, if you will, or an operator. And I just sum over these operators, and this is the given probability I can find given state. Of course, the simple example of a density matrix would be I just take a product of psi psi. So that would be the simplest example. I just have one pure state. This would be my density matrix. It would still describe, however, so the probability of finding this state is 1. So it still describes a pure state, although I am choosing the description in terms of the density matrix. Okay, so that would be a simplest example of a density matrix. So now, in the same way as you have time evolution for the pure states in terms of the Schrödinger equation, which is linear in time equation, you have time evolution of the density matrix, and that's given by the Hamiltonian. So the time evolution of this density matrix is simply given by the von Neumann equation, and it's given by d rho over dt is a commutator up to one over I h bar over the Hamiltonian operator and the density matrix here. Okay, so that's how you find how the density matrix evolves in time. And it's called von Neumann equation. All right, so we have now two operators, H and rho. H is our Hamiltonian operator. We take their commutator, and that describes how rho evolves in time. All right, so you can check this equation by knowing the Schrödinger equation. So again, I can, you know, so you can check this. It's not a proof, but simple check of that is just I really take rho equal to be psi psi, a pure state, and then you know that I h bar d psi over dt is h psi. So that's your Schrödinger equation evolution for the pure state. So now just try to calculate what is d rho over dt for this special rho, and try to massage it in this form, and you will see that that works. Okay. So this is how you would check for pure state. Of course, this is true not only for pure state, but it's true for any state. But I think that's almost proof for any state. Okay, so that will be a proof. So the time evolution here is such that I can always normalize my rho so that the total probability of finding some state is equals to 1. So we have some properties of rho, and so one of them is that trace of rho is equal to 1, which translates to the sum over lambda p lambda equals to 1. So some of the probabilities of finding some state is actually equal to 1. I have to find something. Okay. So finally, if you want to calculate, so you have some other operator, other observable A, and if you want to find its expectation value, so expectation value of an observable described by the operator A, of an observable A, so that's an operator again. So in a given state, you just take A psi psi. It would be your expectation value if you had pure state. But if you have mixed state, it's simply a trace over rho A. So the expectation value small a is given by trace rho A. If I want to find average energy, take rho, I take Hamiltonian, and that's what gives me the average energy. I want to find something else. Yes?
Sorry, maybe you said it, but the psi lambda has to be orthogonal with different lambda, or do we put
these epsilon lambda?
Two different lambda, do they have to be orthogonal?
Or? Do they? If they were the same, I think they still would work, right?
For the expectation.
for the expectation value. I'm not sure. I would still think that I don't really need to impose. It's just adds. You know, if I have two same states, basically, you know, I'll have to check. I don't know. All right. So that's all you need to know about the density matrix. So there's a beautiful rule how you actually find whether the density matrix is just describes a pure state or if it is truly a mixed state. And so what is that rule? Somebody tells me.
Von Neumann entropy.
Okay, we can calculate some entropy. There's a simpler thing I can calculate.
Purity.
Sorry?
Purity.
Yeah, so what is that?
It's the transpose squared.
Uh-huh, exactly. So you know, you can calculate simple quantity, which is trace of rho square. And what happens?
You get 1 over n.
So something else. And so which one is which?
1 is 2.
Uh-huh.
And then something else is more than 1 is 2.
And this will be the mixed state. Perfect. So there's a simple rule how you can check whether your density matrix describes a pure state, and you simply calculate trace rho square. And so if it describes the pure state, it has to be of this form. You know that psi is normalized to 1, so it better gives you 1. And if you have mixed state, you find something else. All right. So that's the quantum mechanical description. And basically what you just described by this density matrix is really statistical physics. What you described is a macrostate. So you described that I'm finding some possible microstate with some probability. It's precisely what you are doing in statistical physics. In statistical physics, you have lots of boxes with different microstates. And so, but if you take that microstate, it has the same macroscopic properties. Each of them has the same macroscopic properties. But I can have different distributions of particles. I can have different things. So the microstate, if I look at what's happening with the particles, is different. But the macroscopic properties are the same. Okay. So then you take these lots of boxes, and you randomly choose this one microstate, one box. And so that gives you, and this is described by the probability. I am finding this microstate is that probability. And so what we are doing here is really statistical physics on quantum states. So that's great. So now let's go back to classical. So when are we classical? So maybe we are just overdoing this. Maybe we can just use classical description, although the quantum mechanical is actually more beautiful. And we will derive the Gibbs distribution using the quantum mechanical description. But anyway, so when can we go? And so let me just use one simple criterion that the Heisenberg's relation tells you that delta x, delta p is certainly bigger than h bar. So now I'm classical if it's actually much, much bigger than h bar. So I will say that I'm in classical regime when delta x, the uncertainty in finding x position and finding p position, is actually much, much bigger than h bar, our quantum constant. Okay, and then I say, well, these fluctuations in the momentum, I'm interested in systems at finite temperature, are caused by thermal fluctuations. So these will be thermal fluctuations. Okay. And so you can use equipartition theorem or something like that. You know that you can relate fluctuations in the momenta to the temperature. And so basically equating delta p square over 2m with kBT, this is the Boltzmann constant, I can find what my fluctuations in the momentum are. So this will be how the thermal fluctuations are induced by the temperature T. Okay, at the same time, delta x, let's say, so I have a gas with lots of molecules, and so the uncertainty in the position of the molecule is basically I have the total number, well, the total volume of the system divided by total number of the molecules. Okay, so this would be the uncertainty in the x position. So each molecule basically takes the volume V over N. Okay, so now plugging this in, I'm finding what? So delta x is this thing here. So V over N, 1/3. And then delta P, okay, so delta P is 2m kb t square root of that. Better be much bigger than h bar. So that's our criterion. And so you can write it, well, this is already it, but you can write it, for example, as a condition for the temperatures. So then I'll just leave temperature on the left-hand side and shift everything else on the right-hand side. And okay, and so what you are finding from there is that kBT is much bigger than n to 2/3 h by square over 2m, where n, small n, is just n over v. Okay, so that's what you find. And so you see that if you have sufficiently high temperatures, you are at a classical regime. And at the same time, you have to have sufficiently low densities. Okay? So if you are on the surface of Earth, this will certainly be satisfied. On the other hand, if you are at the center of neutron star, where the densities are huge, this will break down and you will have to use quantum description to describe what's happening with your electrons and stuff like that. Okay, so for more, you know, most things on the surface of the Earth, it works. Of course, if I start decreasing the temperature and I go to smaller and smaller temperatures, this will again break, right? So you know, close to absolute zero or whatever, strange things may start happening. And I really need to use the full quantum description. All right, are there any questions? Okay, yeah?
So, because it's a much, much bigger, not like a specific break, is it just that it starts breaking down, you figure it out through experiment when you have to start transitioning?
Well, I would say really, you really need to, when these are comparable, I would start using the quantum thing, yeah. Comparable means like of the order 10 or whatever, and they are in the vicinity of the order 10, then I would start using this thing here. All right, so what is the classical physics description? So instead of, so in classical physics, our microstate corresponds to a vector in 6n dimensional phase space, so it's a vector in 6n dimensional phase space. So if we have capital N number of particles, as we had here, then we have 6n variables. So of course, these are just the positions, three-dimensional positions of the particle and three-dimensional momenta of the particle. So phase space sigma n, which corresponds to r to 6n. And these are simply described by the position of the first particle, momentum of the first particle, position of the second particle, and qn, pn. Okay, so these are our coordinates in the phase space, and the microstate simply, you know, is a point in that phase space. On the other hand, a macro state will just, you know, give me a probability that I am at this position and different probability that I am at different position and so on. So a macro state so I need to give this probability, and that's given by the probability distribution. There is a probability distribution. Let's call it Wn. So distribution with n particles. And then again, this depends on all these variables. So Q1 to Pn. Okay, so that's the probability distribution. And basically, now if I take some volume of the phase space and then I integrate over this thing here, that gives me really the probability of finding, you know, that state and its surrounding in that given volume of the phase space. Okay, so then we have the measure. So this probability distribution determines the measure over which I integrate, and this measure is simply mu is w, and then you integrate over the volume element of the phase space, and the volume element of the phase space. Okay, so now there's some stupid prefactors, but it's 3p d3 p1 d3 q1 d3 pn d3 q1. Okay, so that's the volume in the phase space, and as I said, there is some stupid prefactors, and these stupid prefactors are not very important for any calculations, but you can argue what they have to be. And so 1 over n factorial just comes from not overcounting the number of particles. And then you have this thing here, 2 pi h bar power 3n. And so this comes, you can argue for this factor here, from the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So the statement is you have phase space, and of course classically I can go to as small regions of the phase space as I want, but quantum mechanically this is no longer true. Actually, it doesn't really make sense to divide the phase space into regions which are much smaller than delta x delta p equals to h bar. Okay, so you have like small volumes, infinitesimal volumes of the phase space, and their size is like 2 pi h bar. Okay, so basically you are dividing the volume of the phase space by the volume of this infinitesimal pieces equal to h bar. So that's the Heisenberg's principle. So I just divide the phase space into these things. But as I say, it doesn't really matter. So for most of the applications, this is simply just some factor here which will stand in front of your integral, and of course it affects its actual value, but you will basically never need it. Okay, so and that's it. So now the statistical ensemble is, again, so I have lots of boxes. Each box has the same macro state. It describes the same physics, it has the same, I don't know, viscosity, it has the same energy, average energy and stuff like that, but microscopically they are different. So they can actually be in different places of the phase space. Okay? And so, okay, so statistical ensemble. Let's just write it, statistical ensemble. Plus two large number of boxes with the same macro state, with the same macro state, and basically we can pull one out, and that will give, you know, the corresponding micro state. So I find corresponding microstate. If I open one of the boxes corresponding microstate with probability mu. Okay, so this is how you do it in statistical physics, which is the classical one. This is how you do it in the quantum mechanical one. So finally, of course, what you want to do is that you also want to calculate the expectation values of some observables. So let's say I have an observable A, which is now no longer an operator. It's some function of Q and P. And so now I want to find its expectation value, and then simply given by the integration over this measure here. Okay, so the average value of A, which is whatever we called A, is the expectation value in classical sense now, is simply given by the integral of the corresponding observable APQ, and then times this measure. So maybe I should, well, whatever. It's PQ d tau n. Okay? So this is how you find the expectation value now. And so let me just finish with this dictionary, basically. So provided that the conditions are nice, meaning I can actually go from quantum to classical. Right? Oh, here we go. Then I can actually translate whatever I have quantum mechanical to a classical one. And so I have this nice table here, which I think is nice. So some description, which is this thing here. And then you have the quantum one. And then you have the classical one. Okay. And so we can start with the stage where everything is happening. So the stage, in one case, we have the Hilbert space. H and the classical the classical counterpart of that is the phase space. Sigma n. Okay, so you can go from one to another if your system has a classical limit. So now I call it mass, but whatever. So here, how you do basically how you calculate quantities is that you calculate some traces. You calculate trace rho A or trace rho or whatever. So this is how you do the mass, is that in one case you just trace over things, in the other case you just do the integration over things. Okay, so I have this thing and you integrate over d tau n. So trace just becomes an integral over this measure here. So then how do we describe the statistical ensemble? Statistical ensemble in one case is described by the density matrix rho, density matrix rho. In the other case is the probability distribution W. Okay, and so we know that this guy is normalized to be trace of rho equals to 1. Sum of probabilities is 1. Of course, this must be the same true here. So W d tau n is the normalization of the probability distribution. So that's the normalization. If I open all boxes, I have to get 1. Okay, so the observable here, in one case it's the operator, Let me put hat here, so that's what is whatever we called before A. Okay, let's put operator A. And in the other case is the phase space function A EQ, the phase space function. Okay. And then finally, if you are interested in the expectation value or you know, the average, then you have here is just trace row A, and here is the integral over. A W D tau N. Okay, so this is the expectation value. Expectation value slash average. And this is how you do it. So I don't know. Who has done quantum mechanical statistical physics? Okay, lots of you, so very good. So now this is really the transition. And so the only tricky part really going from quantum to classical is precisely in determining this 3 factor 1 over n factorial 2 pi h bar to 3n. So everything else is straightforward. It's just really that you have to divide by minimal volume of the phase space. That requires some argument. And then you have the 1 over n factorial, so also some argument. As I said, you will not really need it. So that's why everything is straightforward. Questions? Everybody happy so far? Excellent. So we have that. So that was part A, from quantum to classical. Let me just very briefly mention what you get from this von Neumann equation at the classical limit. So let's call it Liouville's equation, whatever. So part B, Liouville's equation. And so provided that you can really describe your system classically, there must be a way how you can write a classical counterpart of this von Neumann equation. And you know, the prescription is, of course, super simple, is that I basically replace the operators with the corresponding classical variables. Okay, so I will now no longer have Hamiltonian as an operator, but I will have a classical Hamiltonian. So I will take the classical limit. Basically, I delete hats, right? And then rho will become our probability distribution, Wn. The commutators will become what?
Right.
Poisson brackets.
Will become the Poisson brackets. And I kill ih bar. Okay, so this comes from if you have qp, the Poisson bracket is 1. But if you have qp, the commutator, it's ih bar. So basically, I have to kill ih bars and just replace them with 1. And so then it's obvious that this equation now becomes an equation dw over dt equals to hw, which is the Liouville's equation. Right. So that's the classical limit of our von Neumann equation. So now what we can do is a miraculous thing, is that we can actually move this thing on the right-hand side and switch the order. So if you remember from classical mechanics, we had a beautiful formula, is that if our observables were explicit functions of time, then their total derivative in time is given by the Poisson bracket plus the explicit derivative in time. So this is precisely that. Okay, so as a consequence of this equation, and by the way, this, okay, so what I haven't stressed is, of course, the quantum mechanics is unitary theory. Okay, so you have unitary time evolution. Okay, so that's precisely captured by the Schrödinger equation, but more generally it's captured by this von Neumann equation. So this is a unitary theory. Okay, so the Slew-Wills equation here comes from the unitarity of the fundamental quantum mechanical theory. Okay, so anyway, so what this means is that dW over dt, which is now, I have to swap the order, vh, I think, plus dv over dt equals to zero. That's our Liouville's equation. Okay. And so, as a consequence of the unitarity of the evolution in quantum mechanics, you are getting that this probability distribution, as it evolves, the total derivative in time actually is zero. It's a consequence of unitarity of quantum mechanics.
But that total derivative, for me to interpret that, I have to choose a path on phase space, right? And so how do I interpret it?
In fact, the very path, my statement is that the very fact that you can actually describe Hamiltonian mechanics in terms of the vector flows and the corresponding time evolutions and whatever, everything follows from the fact that the quantum mechanics is actually unitary.
Oh, you're saying that equation defines a path which is the flow of the Hamiltonian?
Yeah, if you want. Yeah. Okay. So all the Hamiltonian vector flows and everything simply follows from the fact that your quantum mechanics is unitary. All right. So that's it. This is great. So another consequence is, well, okay, so I want to satisfy this thing here, dw over dt equals to zero. So one simple solution of this is that w is a constant. If it's a constant, then this will be true. So one possibility is that w equals to constant. In other words, that finding any given microstate, while they are all equal, all these microstates are equal, I'm finding them with the same probability. Do you know what this means? How is this called in statistical physics?
Microcanonical.
This is the microcanonical ensemble. Microcanonical ensemble. And so that's one possibility how you satisfy this, which comes from quantum mechanics Liouville's equation. Okay, so you derive the microcanonical ensemble distribution that W can be constant. Satisfies this equation, so it's fine. Okay, so now this is great. You can work in, doing statistics. You can do statistical physics, the whole statistical physics in microcanonical ensemble if you want. Why you can do that is that in the end you are interested in systems which are very, very large, which have almost infinite number of degrees of freedom, well 10 to 23 or whatever degrees of freedom, and then it really does not matter which ensemble you choose. To describe your things. So description in one ensemble will differ from the description in the other ensemble by 1 over n to some power. So if n goes to infinity, in the end they will give the same result. So you can, rightfully use the microcanonical ensemble to do all your calculations in statistical physics. However, the problem is that this is quite complicated, and that's why people don't do it. So the problem here is that the energy is actually fixed to be something. So the energy is not, the energy is not allowed to fluctuate, and so you have to really impose delta function energy equals to some value. Okay, and so if you impose that, then of course you have some delta functions in your distributions and stuff like that, and so the calculations are quite complicated. That's why people use a different ensemble. So there's another way how I can satisfy this equation here. And the other way is that possibility number two which quantities have a property that if you take a total derivative with respect to time, they give you zero? Thank you. Any guesses? By definition, a quantity whose total derivative with respect to time is equal to zero is a
conserved quantity.
It's a conserved quantity. It's an integral of motion, right? So the second possibility, so possibility two, I just satisfy this equation dv of dw over dt equals to zero by setting that w is a function of conserved quantities. Or integrals of motion. Okay. So now the problem is that you don't actually, in general, if you have a large system, you don't have that many integrals of motion. So for example, we talked about the Runge-Lenz vector, but it's only present for very special potential 1 over r. And it's only present if you have two-body problem. If you add another particle into the interaction, so you immediately lose extra integral of motion. There won't be any Runge-Lenz vector. So adding more and more particles, it's very unlikely that I can form a configuration where there will be extra integrals of motion. So in fact, if you have 10 to 23 particles, it's impossible to have extra integrals of motion. So the only integrals of motion which are actually allowed are those which are dictated by the symmetries of space-time. So for example, my space is isotropic, so I will have conserved quantity, which is the angular momentum. Or my space is translational invariant, so I'll have conserved momentum, or I have conserved energy. Okay, so the only quantities which actually survive that many number of particles and can survive that are just these. So it's the energy, it's the momentum, and the total angular momentum of the system. Okay, so these are the only that survive that many number of particles in general. And all the other integrals of motion simply will not exist. However, so this thing here describes the motion of the whole system. Okay, that the total momentum of the system is the total angular momentum of the system. So you would be interested in these, provided that, for example, the whole system was rotating. So if you want to describe rotating fluids or something like that, you would be considering W as a function of L. But that's not what people typically do. So people just not interested in the total rotation of the system. So this is not really interesting. And they are not interested in the total motion of the system. They typically, well, if you want to study, I know, black body radiation in motion, yes, then you would have momentum. But you can always go to a rest frame of the thing so that total angular momentum is zero and the total momentum is zero. So this is also not interesting. Okay, so can be removed by studying the system in the right coordinates, unless we are really interested what the motion does to the system, which typically people are not. And so we find that W is just function of energy. Okay, so this is a tremendous simplification which comes from this Liouville's equation, right? So we started with W, which was the probability distribution, which is a function of all possible coordinates of Q1, P1, Q2, P2, and so on, right? But now we know from von Neumann's equation that W can be only function of energy. Okay, so isn't that amazing? So now W is just function of energy. But we know actually more. So consider two non-interacting systems, and so each of them is described by the corresponding probability distribution. So now, what is the probability distribution of both of them? So it's simply a product of W1 and W2. So now the total So I take the probability distribution for one, take the probability distribution for the second one, and that's my new probability distribution. Okay, this is an amazing formula. Why is it amazing? Because I can take logarithm of this formula. Okay, so this is great because now we can do logarithm of W1 plus logarithm of W2 is a logarithm of W total. Okay, so we changed multiplication to addition. That's amazing, because we know that if the systems are not interacting, then if I have energy of one system and energy of another system, the total energy of the two will be just sum. Okay, so I'm summing one energy to another energy, I'm getting the total energy. So this formula reminds you that. So basically what I'm saying here is that, you know, this thing here must be some multiple of the energy one. This thing here must be some multiple of the energy two. And this is the energy of the E1 plus E2, which is the total energy. Okay, and so this is, there's no any other way how you can satisfy this. And so in other words, you just derived that the probability distribution W, which is only function of energy, is exponential of beta E. Which is the Gibbs distribution for canonical ensemble.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But when you have two subsystems in general, you can't remove both of the momentum.
You can't remove both of them. What do you mean?
Momentum. Because if you they have the momentum mutual.
So yeah, well, okay. So here, what I'm talking about, yeah, right. So this would be like the center of mass momentum,
mm-hmm.
right? So in that case, well, you're right. So one system would have a momentum, the other one would have a momentum. The total momentum is zero. Yeah, but if you want to collide two systems, maybe you cannot forget about this. But if I have one gas here sitting happily here, another gas sitting at the same place happily here, then this is fine. Okay. So anyway, so this is like really the shortest way to get the Gibbs distribution for the canonical ensemble, and everything follows from the fact that quantum mechanics is unitary. Okay. So this is the result here. There are many other consequences of this Liouville's equation. So of course, this Liouville's equation is equivalent to our Liouville's theorem about the cat. So if you have the cat and the time evolves in the phase space, it just gets deformed, but the volume does not change. It's two lines to show that from this equation. In fact, from this equation here. It also tells you really that you have divergence equation, conservation equation in the phase space. Right, so there's a conservation of the flow in the phase space. All right, so you can read it in the notes if you are interested in. What I now want to do is that I want to rederive this in a more fancy way for a quantum mechanical system. Okay, so let's try to rederive this most important result for statistical physics, but now starting from the quantum mechanical description. Are there any questions? All right. So let's do the general Gibbs distribution in quantum statistical physics. And you can derive it from a principle, which I like. The title of the principle is the principle of maximal mass. So that's a nice principle. So you always want to maximize mass described by the entropy. Okay, so part C is the Gibbs distribution. And so let me make a definition. So now we are at the quantum mechanical level. And so we define the definition. We call the following quantity statistical or von Neumann entropy, statistical or von Neumann entropy, and it's given by S is minus KBT, KB trace rho logarithm of rho, where rho is your density matrix. Okay, so this is the definition of the new quantity. You just take rho logarithm of rho, you trace over that, and you call that a statistical entropy or von Neumann entropy. So now, this entropy here, when it's traced rho log rho, is not only interested in for statistical physics, in which case you just put a constant for statistical physics KB, but you could also do it in information theory. And so you may also characterize how much information is in given text of the book or whatever. And so you would just put a different constant here. And that would be the corresponding entropy / information. Okay, so this is quite nice quantity here. But anyway, so for statistical physics, we have this definition. Of course, I'll be setting, if I can, KB equal to 1 for most of the parts. So it's just minus trace rho log rho. Okay, so then there's a principle which allows you to derive the distribution, and it's the principle of maximal mass. Principle of maximal mass. And that states that the density matrix rho representing the equilibrium state of a microsystem is such that it maximizes this statistical entropy, but this is not everything. You have to actually take into account the macroscopic conditions. So this is, so you want to maximize the statistical entropy, but subject to the macroscopical constraints. Okay, so that's the principle of maximal mass. And what it gives you is it really gives you a variational principle for your density matrix rho. Okay? So in the same way as in classical mechanics, we have variational principle for the trajectories of the particles. So now we have a variational principle for the density matrix rho. If you want to find a microstate described by this, well, if you want to find rho for an equilibrium system. All right, so now what does it mean? So let's say that I already prescribe this, the matter here is that I have some constraints. So for example, I know already that my average energy of the system is equal to something. Okay, so then I'm asking, provided my energy, average energy is equal to something, you know, what is the corresponding density rho for my equilibrium system? Okay, so similarly, you can describe something else. So maybe you can say average number of particles in the system are equal to something, and energy equals to something, and something else equals to something. What is my density matrix here? Okay, so in other words, so the constraints are basically nothing else than I'm prescribing that the average value of some observable AI is this one here, rho AI for some, you know, I can run over some quantities. And of course, always I have to have that trace of rho equals to 1. So these are my constraints. I'm prescribing the average energy is equal to E, or something like that. Average number of particles is equal to N. So these are the constraints. So very good. So now we can write down the action functional, which we are going to vary, of course. So the action functional I, well, now we can use the method of Lagrange multipliers, right? So we want to extremize the entropy S, but now we have constraints. And so in order to add constraints to my thing, I use the method of Lagrange multipliers as we did in classical mechanics. Okay, so my action is now S minus sum over I, lambda I are Lagrange multipliers. And then the constraint is, which way I want to write it, trace rho AI minus AI, and then minus lambda zero trace of rho minus one. Okay, so that's my action functional now, which I want to extremize. So it's the entropy plus Lagrange multipliers time constraints. So lambda I and lambda are Lagrange multipliers. And so that's what the principle of maximum mass says, is that not only the entropy I have to take into account and extremize that, but I also take into account the constraints I have. Well, let's vary it, right? So now we require that zero equals to delta I. Okay, and so we vary this with respect to the density matrix. That's our unknown, which we are trying to find. So we will do the variation with respect to delta rho. Okay, so S is minus trace. And so I have rho log rho, of course, which gives me two terms by the Leibniz rule. So it will be delta rho log rho, and then I will have another term is plus, and if I differentiate the other one, log rho, it's 1 over rho delta rho, so rho is just plus delta rho. Delta rho, so that's the variation of the entropy. Okay, so now the variation of these constraints, so it's minus sum over I, lambda I are just functions. I don't vary those. So trace of AI delta rho. This is just a constant, that's zero, minus lambda zero trace of delta rho. All right, so this is amazing. So now I can put everything together. And so remember, when we were doing the variations in classical mechanics, we always wanted to put it like something times delta q, right? So we want to do it here as well. So now delta q becomes delta rho, so we want to write it something times delta. Okay, so this is equal to, and the statement is that it can be written as, I don't know, plus or minus, let's see if that works. Okay, so trace of something, let's call it B, delta rho. So what is this B? So B is minus logarithm of rho from this thing, minus 1 from this thing, minus lambda I AI sum over that from this thing, and then minus lambda 0. Maybe. Okay. Hopefully it's right. So now very good. So now we found that our variational principle requires that 0 equals to trace some matrix B times delta rho. Okay? So now of course what I want to argue is that B has to be equal to 0. Okay? So it's almost obvious if delta rho were any matrix. Okay? If you had a trace of B times delta rho for any delta rho, the only possibility would be that B is equal to 0. However, this is not any matrix. It's just Hermitian matrices. Okay, so rho, I didn't tell you, has to be Hermitian. So there's some small subtlety here. But actually, you can show that it's also true if it's just you limit yourself to Hermitian matrices. So the statement is, this is still true. Naively, you would expect that B equals to 0. And that's actually the true statement. So, you know, true. Okay. Well, in fact, it's not that simple. It's not that difficult. So if you take any matrix rho, you can decompose it into a Hermitian part, an anti-Hermitian part. And then you can sort of argue that it works for both of them. Okay. So anyway, so B has to be equal to 0. Well, this is equal to 0. And you see that, okay, so that the logarithm of rho is equal to exponential. Okay, so rho is equal to exponential of some mass here. So from here, you find is that rho, if I put it here, is exponential of minus 1 minus lambda 0 minus sum over I lambda I AI. Okay, so this is what we are finding from here. But of course, we have we can now use the constraint that trace of rho has to be equal to 1. Okay, so now using the constraint that trace of rho is equal to 1, I can eliminate one of the Lagrange multipliers. So let's say I want to eliminate this minus 1 minus lambda 0. Okay. So now imposing trace of rho equals to 1. Well, what is trace of rho? Well, okay. So what's really written here is minus 1 minus lambda 0 times a unit matrix, right? That's what's written there. So they say. And then there's some matrices here. But because it's a unit matrix, it commutes everything, and I can actually trace over that. And it's just, okay, so this is just e to minus 1 minus lambda 0, and then the trace of the rest. Okay, so we are imposing that. And so you see that this thing here must be 1 over trace e to minus lambda I AI. Right? I want to have 1. So this exponent, so I'm solving for lambda 0 so that this is equal to 1. And you see that this thing here, if I set equal to 1 over trace of that, then I solved it. So in other words, we just derived that the density matrix looks like e to minus sum over I lambda I AI divided by z, where z is the trace of that same thing. Everybody happy with this? Very good. So the first row here is called the Gibbs distribution. Gibbs. So density matrix like that is called this Gibbs distribution. Gibbs distribution. Or if you want, generalized Gibbs distribution. And this quantity here, of course, I trace over some operators, so I get a number. It's called partition function. Yes?
Could we have had the constraints on the trace of rho squared, as we saw that?
Oh, right. In which case you would have, you wouldn't have really describing, you know, statistical physics. You would be describing a pure state. I think that would be inconsistent for some reason. I don't know. It's interesting. So could I impose that? That I want a pure state, but I, at the same time, I want this thing here. I don't know. It would probably give you that the entropy is something.
It gives
like zero or something like that, right?
Zero automatically. If you use that trace rho squared equals one, it automatically makes trace rho log rho equal to zero.
That's what it should mean. Yeah, yeah. Then you shouldn't have any entropy then, because you just have a one pure state and there's no. All right. So we just derived the most general Gibbs distribution at the quantum mechanical level, and we derived this important quantity. The partition function, which is just trace of the same thing here. All right. So isn't that beautiful? So now the statement is that once we have this here, we have three important properties which automatically come from here. So three important properties immediately follow. And so one of them is that if you want these average values, AI, you just get them as d log of z over d Lagrange multiplier. So you just differentiate the logarithm of your partition function with respect to d Lagrange multiplier, and you get the average value. I will show that in a minute. And then you have that the entropy is just given sum over I lambda I AI plus logarithm of Z. That's another thing. And finally, you have that the Lagrange multipliers are just DS over D AI. So these are the three important properties which immediately follow from here. Basically, what they say is that if I know the partition function, I know what the average values are, what the expectation values are. Similarly, I know what the entropy is, and then I know what the Lagrange multipliers are. Okay? So everything actually. Okay, so let's just show this one. So we want to prove. How I'm doing this time. Maybe I can prove that. So the first one, so it's just we want to calculate what is minus d log z over d lambda I. Well, if I differentiate logarithm, I get minus 1 over z dz over d lambda I. But z, by definition, so it's minus 1 over z. So z is this thing here. I want to differentiate it with respect to lambda I. So I have to change this index first. So it's just summation index to lambda j aj. But I differentiate here, but trace doesn't do anything with differentiation. It's like an integration. I can swap integration and differentiation. So I can pull it through here. That will be trace d over d lambda I e to minus lambda j aj sum over them. Okay, and so what this differentiation does, so of course these are matrices or whatever the operators, but we don't have to be afraid, we just differentiate as normal and just would bring a AI downstairs. So this is just AI with a minus sign e to minus lambda j aj. Okay, so what this is equal to is, so minus minus cancel, and so it's 1 over z trace ai e to minus lambda j aj. But z is just a number, and I can pull it through the trace. So I can actually move this z here. Okay, but then what is this thing here? It's just the density matrix row. So then I have trace of AI row, trace of row AI, which is nothing else by definition or whatever than the expectation value AI. Okay, so that's how you prove the first one. Okay. I will leave up to you the second one. You can do it yourself. And then finally, if you establish the second one, how do I get the third one? Well, you see, if I differentiate S with respect to AI here in the sum, it brings me lambda I. So that would work if logarithm of Z would not depend on small AI. Right, so if this does not depend on small ai, then the differentiation with small ai just gives me 0 and gives me this relation here. So does logarithm of z depend on small ai? So does z depend on small ai? It doesn't, right? So the only thing which it is function of is small lambda I and the operators capital AI, but not the average values or the expectation value small ai. So this is not a function of small ai, and that's why this thing does not contribute to this derivative. Okay, so the third relation immediately follows from the second. Second is one line equally as this one here. Okay, just show it yourself. Very good, so we have three important relations here. I don't know which table, blackboard to use now. So far, this is completely general Gibbs distribution. And we can impose any macroscopic constraints and to describe our system in equilibrium. But what is the simplest thing is that you choose the canonical ensemble where the only macroscopic constraint which you impose is that the energy, that the average value of the Hamiltonian is energy. Okay. So now let's consider a specific case. Okay, so specifically, special case is the canonical ensemble where you say, where the only observables AI which you consider is that you have the Hamiltonian. So then you have that the average value of the Hamiltonian is the average energy, and that's trace rho H. So the only AI is just H, the Hamiltonian. Okay, if that is true, then my partition function in the canonical ensemble just looks E minus. So now you would have lambda H, but people don't call it lambda in that case. For some reason, they call it beta. Okay, so it's beta H, but beta is the Lagrange multiplier here. And then Z and that is trace of minus beta h, and beta is the Lagrange multiplier. Okay, so that's how our distribution, well, how our density matrix looks when we have a canonical ensemble where we fix the expectation value of the energy. Okay, so now what you can do is that you want to recover, you want to, okay, so this is all nice, but basically we don't know what beta is, and we are not doing physics so far, really. We are just doing mass, we are just extremizing some you know, Neumann entropy, but where is the connection to physics, right? So in order to connect to physics, you need to connect to something which is a physical theory, and which everybody knows, which is the thermodynamics. So now, the important next step is to really make connection with thermodynamics. Okay, so now the connection to thermodynamics, connection to thermodynamics. So only once we make that connection with thermodynamics, then we can actually say we are doing physics. Okay, very good. So what we need to do is that basically we want to use the first and second laws of thermodynamics to tell you what this really means. Okay, so the first step would be to define what we mean by energy and what we mean by heat in this statistical physics description. Okay, so first you want to connect to the first law of thermodynamics. Anybody remembers what is the first law? So energy absorbed by the system is actually, you know, equals to work done by the system plus the heat transfer. Okay, so we have the first law, and of course it's time dependent, and whether, you know, what do you mean, whether the heat is transferred to the system and forth from the system or whatever. But let me just write it this way. So the first law of thermodynamics is dU is delta Q. Okay, let's write it delta. Doesn't matter, delta Q plus delta V. So this is the work, and this is the heat. And this is the work, and this is the energy. Okay, so that's the first law of thermodynamics. And so we better see this first law coming from our description in statistical physics as well. Okay, so in order to do this, we need to define, okay, so we know that the energy, so we know from here that the energy is trace rho h. So d of energy, so delta of u, well, from our definition is delta of this thing, so it has two terms. It has a term where I have delta rho h, and it is a term when I have rho delta h. It looks like first law, doesn't it? I have delta of u equals to sum of two terms. Okay, so now basically it's a definition. What do you mean by heat and what do you mean by the work? So what do you think, which one is which? So in one case, I'm doing something with the density matrix. I'm varying the density matrix. The density matrix depends on the probabilities. Okay, so the density matrix is probability times the states. Okay, so if I'm doing delta rho here, I'm changing the probabilities. Okay, so for example, if I had it's a stupid example, but anyway, if I had some atom and then I would have electrons or whatever at some energy levels, is that basically what this thing is doing is sort of moving particles, electrons from one energy level to another. So it's actually changing the probabilities of finding that many particles on that level, that many particles on that level. On the other hand, this term here, what it is doing is changing the Hamiltonian. So it's changing the energy levels. So it's basically, for example, I apply an electric field and it moves all the energy levels which were here a little bit up. Okay, so that's what this term is doing. So this one changes the energy levels, so moves energy levels, This one changes the probabilities, So now, which one do you think it's more natural to call heat, and which one do you think it's more natural to call work? Sorry, which one is work? First one. Who thinks it's more natural to call work? First one, changing the probabilities. One, two. Half.
What's the question? What's
work?
So which one should we call work and which one should we call
heat? What was the option that you just...
Okay, so we have two terms. Okay, let's look at this term here, right? So we are shifting the energy levels, right? So how can I shift the energy levels? Is it difficult or is it easy? For example, I take your atom and then I apply external electric field.
For example, if I had a particle in a box, I could push the walls together.
Uh-huh.
That would increase.
Does it shift the?
So that's work.
Okay. Well, okay, you told everybody. So you spoiled the survey. Shame on you. So this is the work. And this is the heat. So it's much more difficult to actually, to really take control over the probabilities. So the probabilities are really, really bad to control. I don't know how to control the probabilities of occupation of various states, but moving the energy levels is quite simple. And so that's why this is called work, and that's why that is called heat. Okay, so we have this definition, and with this definition, we recover the first law. Okay, perfect. So we have the first law. We still don't know what beta is, so let's recover the second law. So the second law, anybody knows what it is in thermodynamics? Something to do with the entropy, blah, blah, blah.
It goes up.
Okay, so there's many formulations of the second law, but I will choose the one due to Clausius. It's basically saying, well, if I have the heat, delta Q, I just write it as T delta S, okay? Okay, so then there's a Clausius relation, and that contains information about the second law, and it tells you that delta Q is T delta S. Which sometimes people use as a definition of temperature as well as entropy at the same time. But anyway, so there's this beautiful Clausius relation which tells me the heat is actually T delta S. By the way, it's not the emperor Clausius in ancient Rome. It's a different Clausius. All right. So very good. So we have this. So now let's calculate what delta S is and compare whether we, this relation is whatever. Okay, so we calculate delta S. We don't have space. So let's calculate what delta S is. Okay, so we know that S is minus trace rho log rho, right? So our S is minus trace rho log rho. So delta S, well, has two terms. It's minus trace. If I differentiate the first one, it's delta rho log rho. And if I differentiate the second one, it's just delta rho. Very good. So two terms. So now I can use for logarithm of rho our form of rho, for the canonical ensemble. Okay? So logarithm of rho will be minus beta h, and then there'll be also logarithm of z. So this is equal to minus trace delta rho, and then there will be minus beta h, and then minus logarithm of z plus delta rho. Okay. And so the first term is a minus, this is a minus, so it's plus. And so beta is just a number which I take outside. So it's beta trace of delta rho and h. That's the first term. And then I have a term plus something trace, and then there's something here, delta rho. But there's something here is just a number. So it's this logarithm of z, and it's this one here coming from there. Okay? And so logarithm of z is a number, and delta, and then 1 here is a number. Okay? There's an h, and this is a number. So now anybody knows what this is? So I can take the number out, okay? And I have trace of delta rho. What is that? That's zero. Why is it zero? Because we know that trace of rho is 1. Okay, if we vary that, if we vary 1, it's 0. So we have trace of delta rho is equal to 0. Okay, so this is just a number times trace of delta rho, but trace of delta rho is 0 because trace of rho is 1. Okay? So then this is just beta times trace of delta rho h. But in order to recover our first law, we identified what trace of delta rho h is as a heat. So this is delta q. This is beta delta q. All right, so now we want to compare to the Clausius relation. And so we conclude that beta, we are comparing delta s equal to beta delta q, is delta q equals to t ds. We conclude that beta is 1 over t. And so now we finally know what the Lagrange multiplier beta or lambda is in this case, and it's just 1 over temperature. Beta is related to temperature. And so then you can everywhere write, instead of beta, you can write 1 over t here or 1 over t here, but people don't do it. They just keep beta.
Can you just repeat the thing with the delta q? Because I missed it. You said.
Oh, this term here?
No,
the delta q here.
Yes.
Why we call that delta q?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's basically up to you, right? So you have, you know that u is trace of rho h,
mm-hmm.
Okay? So delta u, we definitely have two terms, this term and that term.
Mm-hmm.
So now you want to make connection with the second, with the first law, which is delta q plus delta w. So now it's basically up to you to call which term you want to be what. Right, so, but I was trying to argue, I was not very convincing maybe, is that this term here is more related to work.
Yeah.
And it, actually you can really affect, you know, you can move the energy levels by applying some conservative forces and stuff like that. Or actually you can extract some work by moving the energy levels.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why it's more natural to call this one work, whereas it's much more difficult to really control the probabilities of states, okay? And that's why this is like a lost energy in the heat, okay? So this one contains delta PM, this one contains delta energy levels, And so this is much more difficult. That's why people call this heat, and they call this work. Okay, but anyway, so once you make the definition, you just call this to be delta Q, and you just call that to be delta W. Okay? And then I'm using this definition here. I don't know why I'm over time, but I have to tell you this. So finally, it makes sense to define F free energy to be minus T logarithm of Z. So that's a definition of the free energy. And so this free energy better agree with the thermodynamic definition of the free energy. But you can actually calculate it. So we know from this relation here, which you still have to show, that S is beta, which is the Lagrange multiplier, times the corresponding average value, AI is our, in our case it's U, it's beta U, plus a logarithm of Z. This is what we know. But we now define, so we can, so beta is 1 over T, so we can multiply by T. So we have ST equals to U minus T logarithm of Z, which is F. So in other words, F is U minus TS. This is precisely the relation how the free energy in thermodynamics is defined. If you know the energy, it's a Legendre transformation of energy minus TS. So this definition really gives you the free energy as you know it in thermodynamics. Okay? And so that will serve as a, you know, basis for calculations. So basically, all you have to do to calculate anything is choose an ensemble. So the simplest one is the canonical one. So you know that rho is given here. So then you know that the partition function is just is just trace of e to minus beta h. Okay, you calculate this partition function, and using the partition function, you can find the free energy. If you know the free energy, you know everything about the system. You can use the thermodynamics to calculate what are the properties of the system. So we will do it next lecture for a free gas, and then we will go to phase transitions. Questions? Isn't this beautiful?